At 0800 hours, prisoner Murphy,
through carelessness on his part, was found dead in vent shaft 17. He seems to have been sucked into a ventilator. Prisoners Boggs and Rains are missing. There seems to be a good chance that they have met with foul play at the hands of prisoner Golic. We need to organize and send out a search party. I can only hope we are able to all pull together over the next few days until the rescue team arrives for Lieutenant Ripley.
It's here. You got Clemens.
Stop this, Ravy, at once.
I'm telling you. It's here.
Welcome to the Three Men and a Retrospective Podcast, Alien Retrospective Series.
Is this going to be a stand-up fight, sir, or another bug hunt?
Join Garrett.
Check it out. I am the ultimate badass.
Yes,
state of the badass art. You do not want to fuck with me.
Matt.
I work for the company, but don't let that fool you. I'm really an okay guy.
And Adam.
You've been in my life so long. I can't remember anything else.
As they go to another system and investigate the popular horror science fiction series where no one can hear you scream.
This is so nuts. I mean, listen to what you're saying. It's paranoid delusion. It's really sad.
From the 1979 original.
Take a look at this, man.
All the way through Alien Romulus, this newest installment coming out this year.
Did IQs just drop sharply while I was away?
The boys will examine each film individually and find out what the company's real intentions are.
Looks like love at first sight to me.
So strap yourselves in, podcast listeners.
Stand by.
The Percolated Media Alien Retrospective begins now.
Let's go!
Alien 3, released May 22, 1992, budget on this eventually went up to $60 million, box office $159.8 million, and this is directed by Mr. David Fincher. Matt, am I correct in saying that in the years me and you have been doing this, this is the first time we've covered a Fincher film, isn't it?
Correct.
And this was almost the last Fincher film, because, you know, guys, when we talked DC last year or the year before, we dived into a lot of the things that affected those productions as far as behind the scenes. I don't think we will talk about a production history and a studio more than we will in the course of this production, because holy shit, what a production history this movie has. Now, Adam, you were alive with me around this time. Were you hearing what was going on? Did you pay attention to the trade papers, Premiere Magazine and things, and see that there was shit going on with this production?
None whatsoever. All I knew is that it was coming back, Sigourney was back, and that was all I really knew, especially at the time. I just wasn't reading Parade and all the other type of trades that they had for that kind of stuff. It just wasn't my bag. So, no, the only thing I knew is Alien was back, and it was a trilogy now.
Funny you mentioned that you knew that it was coming back and Sigourney was back. The reason why people knew that is right off the bat, we have proof that the 20th Century Fox really didn't know what the fuck they were doing, because while they were starting this, they ran a teaser trailer that appeared. It opened up a lot like the first Alien teaser trailer, where we're seeing the egg and we're seeing stars, and we've established that in space, no one can hear you scream. And pretty soon you will find out that on Earth, everyone can hear you scream, and we hear the egg hatch, and it hatches right near Earth. So they are advertising that aliens are coming to Earth. Guess what? That wouldn't happen for another 12 years? 14 years?
It took a spinoff for that to happen.
Yes. But it wasn't going to happen in the movie that they were making. So, of course, right away we know people don't know shit. Now, before I get into this, Matt, you've heard about the production history of this one, right?
It's kind of impossible not to, especially if you have any familiarity with David Fincher as a filmmaker or as a creative mind, because everyone talks about how he acts like Seven is the first movie he ever made, and that's because of the experience he had working on this production. He is quoted as saying, "Nobody hates this movie more than me," or something along those lines. And that's kind of a strong thing for a director to say, especially when A, it's your first job directing a movie, and B, he's made 10, 11 movies afterwards, so it didn't kill his love of directing, although I'm sure it put a significant dent in his desire to work with a big studio or attach himself to an established property. I think that's why so many of his adaptations have been, or so many of his films have been adaptations of books and other source material that are not pre-established, like film properties, because it's kind of easier to work with one author, or sometimes two, versus a giant studio conglomerate. Fox is basically between this X-Men that we talked about a couple years ago, they're the Weyland-Yutani company of film studios, because all they care about is getting their property by any means necessary, filmmakers and moviegoers expendable.
Yeah, Fincher did quit directing film after this. He went back to doing music videos because he had worked with Madonna prior, and he went back to Madonna, as me and Adam mentioned last week. He went back to doing Madonna videos like Bad Girl and things like that. And it took the convincing of one Arnold Copelson to convince him to come back. And he had a script that he wanted Fincher to really do called Seven. And maybe eventually we'll get to that movie. But that was the one that really sparked his interest back into directing. Because after this experience, after he came in so wide-eyed, so excited to do what Ridley Scott and James Cameron did before him, and to go through this experience, I couldn't imagine. When we talk about this, I just could not imagine how much it dents your love of what you were going to do. So, all right, guys, ready to get into this? This is nuts. So,
I mean, this shit's insane.
It is ridiculous. So, after Aliens comes out, big success. Of course, Brandywine Productions, they were keen on doing another Alien film. And Giller and Walter Hill, they were just like, I don't know. Have we said all we needed to say about this? But they eventually went with this concept of aliens as biological weapons. So they brought in, script number one, they brought in William Gibson, cyberpunk writer. And he came in to do a draft of this. And they wanted him to do it quick because there was going to be a strike at the end of the year. This was in 1988. I remember the strike, actually. And he turned a treatment in that was basically more action-oriented. It was Weyland-Yutani basically facing off with the military culture that Cameron established last time. It was a two-film concept where Hicks was going to be the central part of it, of the first film. And Ripley would have a cameo at the end of the first film. And then the fourth film would have Ripley taking over once again to take on these aliens. And I thought this concept, when I read it, it was interesting. They have since turned this into a comic. Adam, were you aware of that?
I know that there's been a release of it. I haven't read it. And actually, I assume that it was just a slavish recreation of this, like Dark Horse takes its licenses and then has done a bunch of that kind of stuff. That's all I thought it was. So no, I didn't. And actually, I'm pretty damn interested. Might need to look this up now.
Yeah, it was released in 2019. And this was looked at as a concept that a lot of people look at it as a better concept than what they ended up with, including William Gibson, because of course he's going to say that. So he did this treatment, and then they brought in, God, how many times are we going to talk about this guy? Rennie Harlan, he was brought in, and he wanted to take this script, and he wanted to go a different direction. He wanted to go to the alien homeworld, and he also wanted to have aliens invading Earth, because he wanted to differentiate himself from Ridley Scott and James Cameron's vision. Which, again, we would eventually get that. And I'm assuming this was the pitch that made Fox go, okay, let's just go make that trailer now. Him and Gibson worked on another treatment for this. Again, Hicks is still in the script. And producers were, they didn't think it was that interesting. They liked the fact that Alien was kind of a metaphor for HIV in it. But they felt it lacked the human element present in Aliens. And they really wanted more of Gibson's aesthetic inside of it. And so they wanted Gibson and Harlan to do rewrites, but at this point Gibson was like, you know what, you guys are dragging your feet, I'm gone. And again, I would really recommend people check out the comic book series that they did on this. I read a portion of it. It is very, very interesting what they could have done with that. Matt, have you read that?
I have not, but I do know the script is available on Audible.
Yes.
So it is out there in the public. I'll get to it eventually, but it's probably going to be a while. Especially based on my recent viewing of this.
In the course of this, they asked Clive Barker to come in and do a treatment. And Clive Barker said, have you guys seen what I've been going through with Nightbreed? Fuck you guys, I'm not coming over doing that. Yeah, they asked Clive Barker to do an alien script. That would have been interesting, huh, Adam?
I'm still waiting for him to come back to Hellraiser.
So Harlan eventually, he suggested Eric Rett, who did a movie called The Hitcher and Near Dark.
We should mention that one of the things to come out of Aliens was they used the leftover effects money to finance Near Dark.
Yes. Yes, it did.
So that's another point in Aliens' favor. We got that movie out of it.
Now, Eric Rett's script, it's something that Weaver was fond of, actually. It took this team of Marines, and they boarded a U.S. city in kind of like a biodome in space. There was this huge battle between aliens and military in this huge biodome. But Brandywine, meaning Giller and Hill, they rejected it because it deviated too much from their own concept. And this was when they actually stopped developing two sequels simultaneously and just try getting one done.
It sounded a lot, based on what I've heard. It basically sounded like they were doing a larger version of, like, Assault on Precinct 13.
Yeah, it did sound like that.
The police / the Marines team up with civilians to fight the outdoor threat, and you have to deal with, like, barricading yourselves in. So it would have been something like that. I don't think it would have been the best thing for this franchise, but I can see merit in that idea.
After this, they brought in a guy by the name of David Tui. Now, David Tui is a guy who, Adam, you should be very familiar with, since you're really pushing us to do this Pitch Black fucking retrospective. He was the originator of that series. But he came in, and he was the one who brought the idea of a prison planet to the table. And the fact that aliens were being used for illegal experiments for biological warfare. And Harlan, at this point, he thought that this was too similar to what they had done before, and he walked out, and Fox, as a compensation prize, gave him Adventures of Ford Fairlane. Good on them. So, Tui delivered the script. Now, it should be said that in this script, Ripley's nowhere to be seen, and neither is Hicks. And this pissed off Joe Roth, because Joe Roth said that Sigourney Weaver is the centerpiece of the series, and Ripley is really the only female warrior we have in our movie mythology. So Weaver's called, they give her a $4 million salary, plus a share of the box office receipts, and she wanted the story to be better, and of course, non-dependent on guns. So now Tui goes and he tries writing Ripley into his script. At this point, they bring in this guy by the name of Vincent Ward, because Walter Hill was at a screening of a movie called The Navigator, A Medical Odyssey, and they really wanted this guy. Now, this guy, he would go on. He would have a career after this. You know, he did What Dreams May Come. He was also a big part of The Last Samurai with Tom Cruise. So he'd been a part of big productions after this. But before this, he really wasn't. And his script, which was combined with Tui's, was interesting in that it was a wooden planet inhabited by monks. And they believed that Ripley's crash landing on this planet was a sign that Ripley was Satan. And they really, really wanted to get whatever was in her out, and they were going to do it by any means necessary. And at this point, they brought in John Fasano to flesh out this particular screenplay. And they were all set to film this script to the point where, guys, they were already building sets for it. Matt, you've read about this wooden planet concept, right?
It was like a wooden satellite that yes. They lock Ripley in a dungeon. I think there are a lot of ideas in that script that permeate into the quote-unquote finished product, especially the bald heads. You know, that's a monkish trait. And even some of the costuming, you know, the prison outfits that they wear. So of all the scripts, I can see a lot of infusion from this one being spliced into the one that actually got made.
Yeah, you definitely see hints of it throughout the course of this, to the point where they even gave Vincent Ward a story by idea, because they used a lot of what he brought to this table.
It seems like even right now we're starting to get an assembly of ideas from just a myriad of scripts that we're going to end up talking about here by the time they finish.
Yep, it's been called by some people as the greatest science fiction movie never made. Sigourney Weaver really enjoyed it. She called it very original and arresting. But again, we have this production crew that Hill, Geller, and John Landau, who we unfortunately just lost a few weeks ago at the time we record this, he was really against this. And he wanted to meet up with Ward to make the script a little bit better, make it more fit for an alien film. And Ward at this point was like, fuck this, I'm done. He refused to do that, and he was fired off the project. But I gotta tell you, the basic structure, you can definitely see when you watch this film. So then, Walter Hill and Giller, they did another draft on the Fasano script. And as they were writing this, they brought in another writer, a guy by the name of Larry Ferguson. He was brought in as a script doctor, and Sigourney Weaver hated this script. She said she was written as a pissed off gym teacher. She couldn't stand the way that Ferguson really wrote her scenes. But Hill and Giller, they took a lot of what Ward and Fasano did, and they combined it with Tuohy's earlier Prison Planet screenplay, and then we get the basis of the final film. And a big part of this, too, guys, is that Sigourney Weaver, when she signed, had a clause written in her contract that stated the final draft needed to be written by Hill and Giller because she believed they were the only writers besides Cameron to write the character of Ripley effectively. This really affects how this production is run. It is at this point where they bring in David Fincher. And Fincher brought with him, you know what, when I read this, it blew my mind. He brought with him a guy by the name of Rex Pickett. You guys familiar with the name Rex Pickett?
Hey, wrote Sideways.
He wrote the book that the movie Sideways is based on, yes. And they did some touch-ups on the script. But of course, with that clause in the contract, Giller and Hill always have the final once-over. And they didn't like a lot of what Rex Pickett did. And so they did not give him a credit on this, although a lot of what he did does kind of show up in this film. But I did not think that the writer of Sideways was a part of this production.
But also, by this point, this production has been touched by so many people. The movie should open with a cop coming out with a doll saying, here, here, and here, pointing at every segment of the baby doll he's carrying.
So by the time Fincher steps on set, $7 million has already been spent on strip writing and on sets that are not going to be used. And he has a treatment by Hill and Giller at his disposal, but he has no real story to work with. So he is basically going off the seat of his pants directing this movie. There's so much shenanigans going on. And at this point, Fincher is a music video director. He's not David Fincher at this point. So he is here to do the dream project he's always dreamed of doing, and he is stepping into just some terrible waters because John Landau and Fincher never really saw eye to eye. John Landau was in Fincher's face all the time about, you know, you need to do this, you need to do that. And Giller and Hill were making changes to the script daily. They would come in to shoot things that they had prepared the day before just to be told, nope, that's being scrapped, we're doing something different. And you know what? As a teenager watching this film, I couldn't see those things. And watching it now, you can definitely see the differences in story that they were going through.
Well, once you get older, the inconsistencies in the production are as clear as day. This is one of the most blatant examples of studio meddling in a big movie where it bleeds into the finished product.
Yeah, it's so obvious from opening to, you might as well put DC Studios on the beginning of this film. This thing feels so meddled.
And at this point, Fincher is able to finally complete production. And in the editing process, he is told that we need some more reshoots done. And that's when Fincher kind of just threw up his hands. He's like, fuck this, I quit. And he basically walked out during the editing process. And as Matt said at the beginning of this podcast, he has not returned to it since. People have asked him about it. He will dismiss most things asked of him. And Matt, you already said the big quote that I was going to say, and that he says nobody hates that movie more than I do. He has kind of opened up. He has talked about a scene that was shot that we'll talk about that the studio refused to let him shoot. That he just basically took Sigourney Weaver, was like, fuck it, we're doing it over here. And he's proud of that particular scene. But other than that, you can't get shit on what Fincher did. But again, like Matt said last week, I'm going to reiterate it, and I have examples to it when we get into the film. This is more a David Fincher film than what David Fincher will say it is.
Yeah, it's got a lot of his trademarks that you would associate with his films. Like, talk about some of the themes, some of his desaturated color grading. There's a lot in here to feel like his handprints are on this. This is not a Alan Smithy type of production where you could have put anybody's name. And certainly this is not all of Fincher's film, as we'll talk about. But there's enough on here for me to still associate with him. So I understand his decision to kind of distance himself, but at the same time, I don't think he can 100% divorce himself from it because he still has his own stamp on it, for better or worse, and we'll talk about whether or not what's here is talked about, because in a lot of ways, this is one of the most notorious, when people talk about when franchises go off the rails, and we talk about the problems with third movies, it kind of starts here in these big genre films. Godfather 3 came out a couple years before this, but that's its own beast entirely. And the fact that I also love how they tried to put out a director's cut, and Fincher's like, I didn't touch a single frame of this. I have no association, so they have to call it the assembly cut. Emphasis on the word ass.
Yes. And the fucking commentary track for this movie is the most boring commentary track I've ever heard, because of course they can't, Fincher's not going to come here for it. So they get all these fucking special effects artists and editor, I think the editor's on it, and I think maybe one or two of the cast members, and nobody's going to talk about the production of it. You know, they're going to talk about the end result of it, and it's boring as fuck.
It's so bad that on the making of documentary, one of several, they cut to H.R. Giger. It's after they talk about aliens, and he goes, "This is where things start to fall apart." But the movie's, like, the characters in this movie, it's got a fan base.
It does.
It's got a devoted group of defenders. Who knows, maybe some of them will be on this podcast. But the trailer for this movie is fucking great. Talk about some of the marketing. Not the one that's basically false advertising because they didn't fall through, but there's, like, a shot of Charles Dance carrying Ripley into the prison planet, and it ends with the reveal of her shaved head.
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty cool trailer. So I think it was marketed pretty well, but I bet a lot of people were like, wait, David, who is directing this?
Yes. And when Ripley comes in, she's like, "You mean you're on a prison planet? You don't have any weapons of any kind?" And it is very, very well done. I'll agree with that. I was hooked on it. I was hooked, line, and sinker, man. By the time Alien 3 had come out, I was ready to see it. However, this was not a theatrical experience. I was not able to get to a theater to see it. For the life of me, I don't know why. I might have been grounded. I don't know. I waited for video. And this thing was released on video in December when we were putting the Christmas tree up. And my mom and dad, they were in the living room putting the final touches on it. And I turned this on in the family room. And I'm watching and I'm like, oh, this wasn't what I expected. But yeah, the marketing, and I sent you guys the Pepsi ad that they ran with this, with an alien getting a Pepsi from these two kids chasing him around. And they had a Sega Genesis game that I loved. It was a side-scroller. It was basically Contra with aliens. Really, really cool, the marketing, when they eventually amped up. But this disappointed when it was released. They expected it to do better business, and we wouldn't get another one for another 5 years. But this definitely disappointed when this came out. Now, Adam, did you see this in theaters?
No, this was definitely a home watch. And I think, I was trying to remember about the time, I would have gone, Dad would take me to movies, but I think it was around the time my parents were getting divorced, so I think that was part of the reason for it. But no, I remember watching this at home, whether it was Black Box, HBO, I'm sure it would have been just as soon as this thing came out on VHS that we watched it at home. And that was my first watch of it. And it was kind of memorable, especially the way that it was broken down to me, because I mentioned it on the previous ones, but my father explained to me why he kind of like went through Ripley's progression. He was Sigourney Weaver's advocate in my own house. He's like, this is why this matters. This is why this matters. This is why she wants this. So maybe he was reading the trades that I didn't do. But yeah, like I got a memorable experience of just what it was like watching it that first time and why the ending mattered and yada yada, everything that went with it that at that young age I wouldn't have fully grasped.
Now, Matt, when did you see this for the first time?
I waited a long time because I have certain people that I trust with their opinions, and no one in that circle advocated for me watching this movie. Part of it is because I have always expressed how much I loved Aliens, and they're like, this movie's going to piss you off in the first 90 seconds, so prepare yourself for that. And I still was caught off guard.
Oh, yeah. It'll definitely catch you off guard. Well, we've had some back and forth about what went on during the making of this. I have more as we get in. But, boys, what do you say we get into the plot of this very disjointed movie? We start off with the 20th Century Fox fanfare getting interrupted by some doom and gloom music, which in this film is being done by the one and only Elliot Goldenthal. Now, I want to talk about the music right off the bat. We spoke about Goldenthal when we did the Batman series. He did Forever and Batman and Robin. I believe we had some nice compliments for him back then. And here, we're getting him again. You know what? I like the score immensely. It is haunting. It enhances the action we see later on. And there are times it reaches a beautiful pinnacle. Adam, as the guy who hated last week's score with every ounce of your being, what did you think of this one?
I'm going to be maligned for you taking what I said out of context again.
And I'm going to keep doing like, it, too. I'm
gonna I feel like it David on. Fincher. Jesus, it was chopped up like an assembly. There we go. I think the score actually does a really good job for the type of movie this is. Though interrupting the classic Fox fanfare with this weird noise is enough to at least make you right off the bat kind of tilt your head sideways like a confused dog and go, huh, what are we doing here? Because you're not used to this way to do it. So I think we're going to talk really quick about this film's nihilistic views, but you know what? This sound really plays into it, and it does it literally right here with the fanfare.
So as far as this movie, the score matching the tone, I think it accomplishes that because this is a very downtrodden, atmospheric horror film more in lines with the first Alien. Unfortunately, I thought the part about me being pissed off at the first 90 seconds was because they cut off the fanfare, because I like hearing that full part, because I always think of the Lucasfilm logo. accompanying it afterwards. So I thought that was going to be the thing that pissed me off. And I remember saying for the first time, if this is all it is, I think it would be okay. And then the movie kept going.
Right during the opening credits. So we're in outer space, and much like the second film, we are where we saw Ripley go to sleep in the previous entry. And here we're seeing the confines of the Sulaco as some acid lands on a pod, glass breaks, explosions happen, fires are started, with the escape pod getting launched into space. Fincher is illustrating this by doing a lot of cuts between credits. You have to give this movie this. It is not starting like the others, and I believe that is a compliment to it.
You could tell that they're doing something different with it here. And remember, it's been a number of years. So, I mean, you kind of are hoping to get a new audience from the first one to the third one. You've got over a decade, so they're doing something different here, and it's a different feel. And for this not being Fincher's film, at least the opening credits here sure feels like some of these music videos I've seen of his.
Mm-hmm, definitely, and we'll talk about what happens in the course of this as we get into the film with the acid and everything.
Well, the editing style reminds me a lot of the Nine Inch Nails video he did.
Definitely.
Where it's really quick, it's fragmented, can't really quite decipher what's happening, but you know it's not good because you can make out the acid blood pretty clearly. So I think it's a provocative opening, and it definitely makes you wonder, okay, what's going to happen next?
We crash land on Fury 161, which is a prison unit that is a planet. And right away, God, I hate to be this guy again, but I think I have to once again bring up the effects. Now, they had a top-notch effects unit working on this production. Richard Edlund, who had worked on Star Wars and headed up Ghostbusters and worked on the first Poltergeist film. So he has quite a reputation. But here, we were a year into the digital effects age, one more year until Jurassic Park would really launch them into the stratosphere. And this effects team, they really wanted to go practical. So all of these effects, with the exception of one, which I'll mention when we get to it, were done practically. And in 1992, a full 17 years after Star Wars, these effects of the ship landing and the creature itself, which we'll get to later, most if not all of them look pretty bad.
It looks like 1992 effects. They don't age well. They really don't. I know even at the time some of the shots, ooh, this is revolutionary to see, but certain things really pigeonhole a time and a place, and early to mid-90s effects are one of them. So the aging of it is pretty bad, but I mean, you're trying to push technology, so I don't fault them for trying to go the route they did with some of their shots.
So, note to all studios, as you increase the number of sequels, you should not feel like you are retroactively stepping back in time with your effects. Your technology should advance, not regress. I think most of the effects work in this movie is atrocious.
Yeah.
And last week, I defended almost everything of Aliens because it never took me out of the movie. In this one, it opens like I'm watching a PlayStation 1 video game. And even some of the effects they use later on, as we'll get into the movie, I think this one dates the worst of the first three. And that's pretty damning considering it's the most recent.
Yeah, I'm with Matt on this. I feel like these effects, instead of going and embracing the digital age, which, like I said, Terminator 2 did the year before, here they are really regressing to rod puppets and things they had done before. When you add the background and you color it up, it just does not look right against that background, and it shows. It shows really badly.
Well, it contrasts with, you see the backdrop of the planet, but Fincher, his visual style is always that desaturated look.
Mm-hmm.
It's really monochromatic. And that does not mesh well with what you're seeing outside. So right away, I'm seeing a color contrast that's throwing me off.
We see a set of guys discover the crash pods as a dog moves into frame, and we know at least one of the four didn't make it. Yet Ripley has. They pull her out of the wreckage, as well as two others, which were the cornerstones of controversy when this film was released. And in the course of this rescue, we learn that both Newt and Hicks did not make it. All right, guys, I gotta say, man, you know, I still go back and forth on this. On one hand, Cameron worked so hard to complete this family unit that we talked about last week, and it was sad seeing them not be able to make it to at least the beginning stages of this film, especially Newt, whose lasting image is of her reaching for the glass of her pod as Fincher cuts to it. More on her later. But on the other end, I think it was wise to make Ripley be what she was in the first film when we see her in the later stages of it. She's alone and with no one to turn to besides some very untrustworthy individuals. Yet according to Michael Biehn, this image they use as they describe his death was a higher paycheck than he received in all of last week's film. I don't know, man. I still go back and forth in decision to this day. I love Newt so much. I would love to have seen what she would have done with Ripley, but you gotta make her alone.
All right, well, I'll be up front. I feel like this movie tells you, oh, you like aliens? Go fuck yourself. That's what this movie does the first couple of minutes. Because all that work, all that investment, it's basically the equivalent then of the Great Depression, where everything just goes to shit and it's worth nothing. To your point, I would have been far more accepting of this, as much as I could be, because I don't think there is a world where I would have been satisfied with killing them off screen and doing it with basically no build up. So because of that, it doesn't mean anything. I would have accepted this if it was Sigourney Weaver, Ripley, entirely alone on this planet. And you made it as primal and centralized as you could. Sort of like the last act of Predator stretched out a full movie. Because I think Sigourney Weaver is more than capable of doing that as a performer. And I think Fincher, even in this movie, is a skilled enough filmmaker, certainly with tension and suspense. And I say this as someone who doesn't like a lot of his movies. Yeah, I know, but I'm going to get shit for that. It could have worked. So the other problem is, if you're going to kill them off, you need to replace them with better characters. And that's where I think it really drops the ball.
Interesting.
Like I said, there's no world where I would accept this as a staunch, borderline devout fan of Aliens. So it's going to piss me off no matter what. And there were plenty of ways you could have at least made this a little bit more of a easier pill to swallow. But as it's presented, I think this is one of the, maybe the worst example, because I had this problem with Nightmare 4. But at least that happens 15 minutes into the movie, and you get reestablished to them, so you remember what their Kincaid and Joey and Patricia Arquette's character. Here, they don't get lines, they don't get scenes, it's just they're killed off-screen, and it's really unsatisfying.
It's funny, it's because we've just discussed it, and I've never had this thought pop into my head until right now. So, this movie at least starts out, and this movie is The Last Jedi of the Alien franchise.
Oh, shit.
I'll say this, I understand the controversy completely. I get it. And when I first watched this, was I upset? Absolutely, because I just watched Alien and Aliens while I was getting ready for this. You separated by a lot of years. Who would you recast as Newt then? Because people would be pissed when you recast Newt, because you have to do that. Michael Biehn was freaking nose deep in a pile of Colombian marching powder and bottles at that point. He may not have even been capable to come back. So I don't have an issue with it, per se. I do think you could have done something with it to be a little more satisfying that hold them so dear from the last film, and I love those characters. But I do think, you know what, you're making a bold move. You have directors and the writing team, other than the ones that are contractually required, they have no stake. They have no emotional connection to those characters. So when you want to make it your own, the only thing you got to stay connected to is Ripley and a xenomorph. And years later, looking at it, I don't harbor any resentment for them making that choice. Because I do think if they were not going to be a family unit through this film, you had to get rid of them, and you had to do it pretty quickly.
So you mentioned a fallacy there that I would like to argue against, and it ties into sort of development of this movie. They mentioned, oh, we can't do an alien movie without Ripley. I think that after Aliens, I would have been fine with being introduced to a whole new group of characters.
Have her ride off into the sunset. Yeah, absolutely.
She gets her happy ending, because that movie's all about overcoming your trauma. This movie, it's sort of what a lot of legacy sequels do, where it's, we're going to bring them back to square one and sort of have them learn the same lesson again. And that's why I think a lot of this movie feels so repetitive for me, among other issues, is that this setting, this prison planet, great, let me get to know these characters and just drop an alien there somehow. We don't need to know exactly how, because all right, I'm going to get this out of the way right now. This is going to be controversial, because you mentioned The Last Jedi. I think this movie is character assassination of Ellen Ripley, the same way you guys felt about character assassination of Luke. And it starts in the opening. After the first two movies, you mean to tell me she didn't check the escape pod for a latched-on xenomorph?
Yeah, that's a big, big plot hole. Yeah.
It's a huge plot hole. Look, if it happens one time, I'm like, okay, I can see. It's happened to her twice. And this is not the only example of assassination I'll use. I'll just call this bullet number one. So we got, let's see, John Wilkes Hill, Charles Giler, and Lee Ferguson Oswald as the three screenwriters I hold with the guns assassinate Ellen Ripley in front of all of us.
Somebody's got to hold the gun in this film.
One of this decision's biggest critics was James Cameron, who really disagreed with the idea to kill these two right off the bat, as in his mind, it just made the Ripley character regress, and it felt like a slap in the face to both him and the fans.
And he should have come back and made the movie. Hey, Jimmy, Terminator 3, 4, and 5. Remember those? The ones that you say are so freaking great every time you want a paycheck?
Well, let's not forget, he was in the middle of making True Lies around this time, but he was against this for so long, yet in recent years, he and Fincher, they've become pretty good friends, and he has been less vocal about it, but he'll rib him about it. But yeah, back in the 90s and all the way through up until 2015 or so, he was really against this.
Yeah, I'm sure Michael Biehn's bank account was also very
exactly. So these guys save Ripley and find that Bishop has negative capabilities. We cut to a briefing as we are hearing that a rescue team has been summoned for the only survivor, and we cut to barcodes on the back of heads, and we are getting a mini introduction to the entire set of dudes we are going to be spending this film's time with. Okay, so a big issue I have with this film is that once the action gets going, which is going to be a while, all of these guys pretty much become anonymous because, Jesus Christ, all these bald heads make them so hard to decipher, and it becomes a guessing game. If you care enough about any of them, of who's who, you're going to be fucking lost.
You're absolutely correct, and that was one of the things that Cameron did brilliantly in the last film. He had different characters that each were identifiable instantly, like in a split second. You knew who you were watching, you knew their personalities and how they were different, and that doesn't exist in this film other than Brock. Charles Dutton. Sorry, he's Rock to me for those that watch 90s sitcoms. Everybody blends together and they don't differentiate them enough. This is what the Colonial Marines could have been without Cameron's touch last week.
Not only are they borderline indistinguishable from a purely superficial level, it's also in the screenwriting. With the exception of one or two, the other 20 to 23, however many are on this rock, all feel like they're written by the exact same person. And it's a symbol of bad writing when 50% of their dialogue is the word fuck.
Mm-hmm.
You know that's bad writing right off the bat, because that doesn't help distinguish them either. Not only do they all look alike, almost all their dialogue sounds the same. They might as well all be clones. You just have one actor play all of them, or make them all androids. And they all have bald heads, so I can't tell who they are. And I guess this is the precursor to the Hitman video game franchise with the stupid barcodes on the back of their head. Can I return these guys then to the store and get new ones?
You know what? This must have been where the tattoo started, because in the 90s, barcode tattoos became freaking popular. Yeah.
Thank you, Fincher. We cut to my dear brother Moopsie himself, Charles Dance, tending to Ripley. Okay, this doesn't happen for a while, but let's talk about this right now. These two eventually end up hooking up. Again, I think there are two ways of looking at this. One, this chick has gone 13 years without getting laid, and her use of him as a sort of one-night stand as a way of getting a little before the fighting starts... Okay, I can see that. On the other hand, some critics said that this takes away every bit of strength that they had developed in the previous two films. Matt, I'm assuming you're with the latter.
Oh yeah, this is bullet number two mm-hmm. in the chamber for character assassination. And what's great about Ripley in the first movie is that character works independent of gender.
Yep.
And then the second one, thematically, it's really about motherhood on top of other things. This one, it's about, certainly, there's some abortion subtext, carrying the term, things like that. But also, I don't like that she does it by flaunting her feminine ways on guys who have not seen a woman for decades. I feel like this character would be above that. She never used her sexuality in the previous movies, because even though her and Hicks had a connection, I don't think it was on a physical, borderline sexual type of level.
I see every single thing that Matt is seeing. It is undeniable. It doesn't bug me when I watch the film. And maybe it's just because I'm like, she suffered in the first one. She suffered in the second one. She wants to get herself a release. So I don't fault her for that. I can see people being like, what the hell? She would never do this. But I don't see a reason to keep Ripley sexless either through the entire franchise. I get it. It just doesn't bug me.
Ripley wakes up as Clemens is about to inject her with a serum. And we see that she has one eye that is very red. Ripley learns that she has crash-landed, and she is told that the others didn't make it. She stands up and asks for clothes, which Clemens suggests due to the ingenuous population that they have around them. We hear that the facility they have used to hold 5,000 people, but has been reduced to 25. Ripley takes a look at the ship, and she's been told that the bodies are in the morgue. She's also told that Bishop the droid was disconnected, and that Newt drowned in her cryotube. As she hears this, she sees a drop of alien blood on the tube. This makes her tell Clemens that she needs to see what's been left of her. Okay, so the opening stages of this movie shows the blood get on the pod. We see glass break, and that's it. My question is, how the hell did this blood on Newt's pod break the glass, not get any acid blood on Newt, and is able to inject Ripley with the egg? This is another huge plot problem I have.
Well, it's also why the reveal that she's pregnant doesn't work, is that it's already been established, because you can make it out in the opening fragments, because you can see the glass broken on her pod only. But you're right, the acid blood is not consistent, although you argued about that with the last movie. But I'm confused also, because in the previous movies, the incubation process for a chestburster is hours. Yeah. Why does it take so long in this movie?
Well,
this film commits, much like Batman v Superman, the cardinal sins of writing. There's too many contrivances, namely the pregnancy timeline and the speed at which the alien can move versus people. I have a lot to say about that later on. There's a lot of conveniences, like Clemens just willingly going along with everything, and this movie's convoluted as fuck.
Well, I can go with the pregnancy angle just for the simple fact that she's not carrying a regular alien. She's carrying a queen. So I can see it taking longer for that to develop. I didn't have too much problem with that the more I thought about it. But you're right. The thought of it taking as long as it has, given what we've seen previously, is a bit of a problem.
Well, yeah, but I was told last week when I had inconsistencies that I was wrong because it's sci-fi and we don't understand it yet. So watching this one. See, but I also had the issue of how did that chestburster finding a way to like cut itself on glass? Like,
yeah.
Did it cut itself on glass? That's idiotic. And we didn't have an alien on the ship. We had a chestburster. The chestburster doesn't stalk its prey like it's a freaking cat. It isn't Jones. So I don't fully understand the machinations behind that. And then it cracked on one. Do we have multiple chestbursters? Because it implanted an egg. But when we've seen chestbursters before, they implant and then they die. They don't keep going. When we look at John Hurt, what happened there, it just doesn't... The contrivances and conveniences, Matt's going to point them out, and he's going to be exactly right, kind of from credit to credit. Sometimes it bugs me, sometimes it doesn't, depending on my mood. And I think you've got to be in a kind of a dark, moody mood if you're going to get enjoyment out of this film. I don't think you can watch this with any type of optimism like the last two films and have any enjoyment whatsoever.
Oh, God, no. This is a downtrodden 2 hours. For sure, this will not put you in a good mood.
No, it will not, but I will also say at the same time, this movie has terrible, with a capital T, instances of quote-unquote comic relief that make this feel even more oppressive. I don't understand the people that like this movie. I'm just curious what they get out of it beyond just having the nihilistic approach of Lars von Trier.
Give me an example of the humor that you saw that didn't work.
The two dipshits that are literally running with scissors, and they're laughing about bumping into each other, even though the fact they're being chased by a murderous alien that's killed at least a dozen of them.
Okay, yep, that checks.
That's why I was going to point out, this is the Fight Club of alien movies.
Oh, jeez. We cut to inmate Thomas Murphy as he looks and sees that his dog is very sick. He checks on him and sees that he is very messed up.
Can I also say, why is it that it's okay to kill dogs in these movies, but everyone has to go back for the fucking cat in Alien? I want some pet equality, goddammit.
I'm with you. And that fucking cat lived the entire fucking time, I'm assuming. We cut to a scene. Can't believe this is real. David Fincher shows the autopsy of a 9-year-old girl. You know, I get it. Ripley needs to know if an alien egg was able to get inside this girl's body. Little does she know it's actually in herself. I get all that, but this scene, goddamn, is it tough to watch.
It's also all in the Foley work and the sound design. It reminds me so much of the opening parts of Seven when they're in the morgue.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the things that I really associate with Fincher, is that he loves deconstructing not just movie structure, but human bodies, how things work. A lot of his movies have to do with serial killers, like Seven, Zodiac, this, its cause of death. And also, a lot of his movies are about dehumanization, which is very much in this movie. And a lot of his characters, these are people who are ostensibly very lonely, troubled, most of them are. Obsession plays a part in a lot of his movies. So his mindset is absolutely in this movie. You could call this Mindhunter, if you will. It's just that the flourishes in a lot of Fincher's movies, the ones I like, he picks really good scripts. Like, I love Gone Girl. I think it's the last movie he did that I liked, but that movie's really well written, and it matches how he shoots his movies and his visual style. Here you get the visual style and the basis of a lot of his movies, but this script is, I'll put it out there, this script is awful. And you could tell that there's multiple writers on it. Because it's incoherent. Scenes, as it literally happened, it feels like it was written scene to scene.
Adam, how do you feel about this autopsy scene, sir?
I love that it's here. And the reason is, any pretense that this is a sci-fi movie is kind of thrown out. This is nothing but a dirty horror film. And I mean dirty in the way that it's shot, written, edited, everything. And it makes it very clear right here. I mean, this is a full-blown, almost like snuff horror scene. It's uncomfortable to watch, and I think it fits with the tone. Do I like it? It's hard to say I like it, but I think it fits in the movie that we're being shown.
And Weaver, to her credit, she plays this very well. She's asking for a moment alone with Newt as they think that she's just going to warn Newt's death. But when she thinks they're not looking, she's actually examining the body herself, looking for the egg. And I love how Weaver's just kind of playing this. I don't think her acting chops have diminished a bit.
I think she's as good as she's ever been, but there's a lot of stuff in her character that I just don't agree with the directions. Like, it's so funny we're doing this right after Star Wars, because I feel about her portrayal in this in a lot of ways the way you guys felt about Luke.
That's what's funny to me, is that on the opposite sides of the coins, we could fight roughly and see it that way. But I think Weaver's actually pretty fantastic. And maybe it's because she's getting to do what she wanted last film, and she has more. So I think when she's getting some of the parts that may not make sense, and even when the scenes I don't enjoy, I think Weaver brings some of her all in those scenes.
What's the red eye for?
It's a part of the sleep that she was in.
Crash.
I thought she was just hungover and bloodshot that day. They just kept filming. They had a hard release date.
Kudos to her, man, because she really did what she needed to do to get back into this character's mindset. Because after the second one, if you recall, she said she was done. And I know they added a few more zeros and a few more numbers to that paycheck to get her to come back. And also, it cannot be overlooked that she's also given a co-producer credit here as well. So I think her mindset was dead set on this. And I'm going to say something that's probably pretty controversial. I think this is her best performance in the entire series. I really like what she does here. Now, Matt, you have a huge point that I completely agree with, and that inconsistencies with her character are here. But I think she gives a magnificent performance in this, even better than
last week. I think that's a fair point. I just think Aliens, I have a stronger read on her throughout the movie. But you know why she's so good in this movie? Because everyone else in this movie is so one note.
You're not wrong.
And I include Charles Dance, who I think is, aside from her, the only one who's really adding some empathy in this and has some variance to his performance. But he doesn't make it through the whole movie, so once he's gone, I'm like, oh, fuck all of you.
And let's talk about Charles Dutton. Charles Dutton was a friend of Weaver's husband, and Weaver, years before, had promised Dutton, look, if they ever do a third one and I'm involved, I will get you on this. And sure enough, she did. One end, he's like, yes, I will kill you. And the other end, he goes, we need you, goddammit. His character is fucking bonkers, and I can't stand the inconsistencies with it.
Yeah, he's also the one that's most inconsistent with the religious yes. obsession. Other parts he comes off as really pious and devout. And other times he's like, oh, F the rule. And I hate to say this, a lot of times he comes off as the cliched tough
he definitely
black
does.
Guy. And that something he does at the end is so... I hate it so much.
I know. Oh, God, I know exactly what you're talking about. Adam, the Rock fan here, how do you feel about Charles Dutton in this?
Exactly like you guys do. Like, I think there's times where he's a welcome presence, but he's all over the place. You could tell that what the character does every 20 minutes is from a different script that he was given before this thing started shooting, because it's all over the place.
The autopsy is interrupted as the superintendent shows up, and he explains that he'd prefer it if Ripley didn't move around the prison as she had earlier. Ripley says that they need to cremate the bodies, and once again, we know why she's requesting this, don't we?
Yes, but I'm confused a little bit. I think this is another inconsistency. The superintendent already sort of prepped the inmates that there's a woman on there, and he's basically mm-hmm. saying, for all intents and purposes, be on your best behavior. So I understand on behalf of the company keeping her safe, but does he really expect her to abide by what he's saying?
No. It's very inconsistent. We cut to the, I guess we can call it, cremation ceremony, as hot pits are opened up. And as the bodies are laid to rest, Murphy's dog dies and gives birth to the new alien, which is going to terrorize the facility.
Oh, by the way, this is so pretentious, having this happen alongside a sermon about death and resurrection.
Yeah, exactly. A couple things here. One, within this movie's first 25 minutes, Fincher has killed both a 9-year-old girl and a dog. That, my friends, is nihilism at its most hardcore. Second, all right, Matt, we're going to touch on this now. In the assembly cut, this was not a dog, but an ox. You know, I like the idea of it being a dog, because I think what they're getting at with this particular film is the fact that the alien takes on characteristics, biological characteristics, of what they have hatched from. I like that idea. When it comes from an ox, which the production called it the Bambi Burster, this was the only thing that when Giger worked on this film, he did do some design work. This was the only thing they kept, was this thing that hatched from this dog and ox. I like the idea that it's a dog, even though they have to kill the dog, because an ox you can't really do anything with. And if they're going to go with it is what it came from, that's what you go with.
Well, it depends what you're looking for. And it depends on the design. Because I will say, I think the ox one is a lot more menacing than the one that comes from the dog. Because there's certain shots in this movie where the alien looks like it's 10 feet tall. And then there's other parts where he looks like an ostrich. And I can't take it seriously. So that definitely bothers me from a cosmetic level. And when you have one alien, because it's not aliens where there's hundreds of them, you got to make sure that your alien looks foreboding and is scary. That first movie, whenever the xenomorph appears, it's actually terrifying. Because of the design, and also because of a lot of the other circumstances around it, I never find the xenomorph scary in this movie. And for something that's trying to be much more of a standard horror film, borderline slasher, it's to its detriment, because it fails in that regard.
I think this is one of those instances where someone's, whether it's writer, studio, Fincher, all of the above, trying to make such a stamp to show what they can do differently that it flies in the face of what we had. Why is there not a chestburster coming out of this dog? Why? That's what happens when the face hugger gets on. Why the change? There's no reason for this other than someone watched The Thing and liked the dog transforming. This just does not make sense from what's been established the first two films. So I got a huge, huge issue with that. It looks cool. It's terrifying. And imagine it's your dog. So it works in that respect. But this does not sit in what we've already established. And that just bugs the shit out of me to no end.
Does it transform? I thought it did hatch.
It emerges.
Did I say no? It's already fully formed.
The skin splits. Okay. It rips apart. It emerges from the dog as a xenomorph.
Okay.
And that's not what it does to a human. There's no little thing that bursts out. If you're changing stuff, I get it, but nothing else changes. So I get it, but it does not sit with the xenomorph. I mean, we're talking about a sci-fi alien freaking horror film, but it doesn't come with what's been established.
Yeah, but we're also talking about something that's been established previously, as you mentioned, and it is kind of a backhand slap to the fact that it hatched from a person from the chest in the previous two films. And your point is very, very dead on, because we are changing things here. Hell, later on, it's going to fucking spit acid instead of bleed acid.
There goes that.
So
note.
They are changing so many things here.
Now imagine if we did just have a chest burster out of the dog. It would have been horrifying, but imagine its owner coming back and it thinks that somebody shot the dog or something like that. And we're seeing that chest burster grow into a different looking type of xenomorph. That would make sense. But I don't get it takes on the characteristics of what it implanted in, because it ends up looking like any other xenomorph by the time it gets to full size in anywhere from 2 minutes to an hour, depending on what you're watching.
Yeah, the only characteristic it takes on is that it runs on all fours when the movie decides it will. Because in other parts, it looks like a fucking Roadrunner.
Oh, God. Let's get to that. Let's talk about how they decided to bring this creature to life. Contrary to certain things I've read about this film, this alien was not the creation of digital effects. What Woodruff and Gillis did was use rod puppets. Sometimes the creature looks decent, sometimes it looks okay, sometimes it looks downright awful, but it never looks good. This effect just doesn't work in the story they're trying to tell. And like I mentioned earlier, when you color it against the backgrounds that they have here, all this rust color, it really stands out as looking bad.
I don't think it looks horrible, the actual alien itself. I do appreciate that it's practical. I do have an issue with the way that it's shot, because I think that they're covering up so many deficiencies with it that contributes to the way that it looks. But the actual practical xenomorph that we get, I don't think it looks as good as what we've had any of the last two films, but I'm not angry with it.
But that's the sad thing, man. We are 13 years removed from that first film. You gotta look better. If you're gonna do it again, do it better. That's the mantra that should happen.
Say that in a lot of movies.
Yes, true.
It's really following in line with horror sequels, because it's like the Michael Myers mask in Halloween where they look shittier to go on.
Why couldn't they get that right? Oh, God, maybe we'll get to that one day. What Fincher does do with this alien that I had forgotten had actually started right after this birthing scene is he uses a sort of POV shot from the alien's POV as it moves. I think this is a pretty effective way of not giving away that your effects just aren't that good. It's sort of the Spielberg 75 method, right? If your creature doesn't look good, just use the POV to show where it's going.
Yeah, that's fair.
I remember it being a story, or maybe even Entertainment Tonight. Look up John Tesh, everybody. But just remembering, ooh, we're going to get the alien's point of view for the first time.
We then cut to Ripley wiping a mirror, and we, the audience, discover, if you haven't seen the trailer that Matt mentioned earlier, she's actually bald. Bold choice. This was Fincher's idea. This came up in Weaver's first real sit-down with Fincher, and she knew from this moment on that she really liked this guy, because this was a real bold choice to do this to this woman who she had been nominated for Oscars previously, and it was for her hair. She did shave this off, of course, for a fee. They did pay her $60,000 more to do it, but I like the fact that we have all these inmates running around, and she would be bald, too.
Yes, but it's such a flimsy line to explain it. Oh, we have a problem with lice.
Yeah, that's the reason.
That feels like such a reshoot line to explain it, even though it was baked into the concept. But that also ties into the theme of dehumanization and sort of like assimilation, where everyone's the same in a lot of Fincher films. It's also kind of taken away her feminine features, even though the movie struggles with depicting her as a strong female character, especially because there's scenes in here that feel like they're inserted solely to make her feel like a stronger character, even though that mm-hmm. shouldn't be there because it's already been established how tough and self-preserving she is.
I think this started a weird fascination and fetish for me that I still can't get over. I think it's been done so many times since that going back and looking at this in retrospect takes away from the impact that it had back 32 years ago now. But I think it's effective. I think it works for what she's trying to do. I could see Sigourney really going with this. And I love the fact that when they did reshoots and they said, oh, you're going to need to shave her head again, she basically got paid the exact same amount just for reshoot than she did to shave her head for the first entire filming sequence.
So she sits down to eat with the rest of the prisoners, and one thing Fincher is illustrating here is even when the alien isn't in the picture, Ripley is always in trouble. He does a lot of low-angle shots here.
Yeah, you're supposed to feel dirty and ill at ease, and I think his shooting style does accomplish that.
Ripley expresses her appreciation to Dylan for what he said at her friend's cremation, and he responds with, "You don't want to know me, lady," as he's a murderer and rapist of women. She doesn't back down, though, and sits right the fuck down across from him. She says that she doesn't have faith, as Dylan says, they tolerate anyone, even the intolerable. And until now, they've had no temptation. Oh boy, this fucking character is just flimsy as putting it
mild. Everything she says in this scene does not carry water throughout the entire movie.
None.
It goes in spurts.
We're learning about the concepts behind the religion they practice, and Ripley asks if Clemens is attracted to her. Oh boy, I could have done without this scene. Is this a... Matt, this is the portrayal of the character, right?
Yeah, this is part of that component where she's using him for the most basic, borderline primal way to get information, which is the Bond girl thing of I'll sleep with you.
I don't see it that way. I can't argue with those that have a problem with it. It never upsets me. I just feel that she's gone through so much shit. She's just over it, and she's going to do what she's got to do.
See, Matt, and one thing you complained about in our last retrospective is this is why I liked how sexless Star Wars was. You don't run into this shit when you pull this.
This movie is really starting to establish the trend of these movies are all just a remake of the first one. It's the third movie where we're introduced to a lot of characters through a cafeteria-style scene.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I didn't think of it that way. We cut to Murphy, who through a variety of circumstances is sucked into this fan and dissipates.
This is comical. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's bad.
Him looking down the shaft and the xenomorph going peekaboo, and he falls 30 feet into the spinning fan, which you think somebody would shut that off if he's going to be working there.
This whole scene
plays for comedy, right down to the fact he might as well be wearing headphones with how loud he's singing.
Yeah, it is. It's comical almost, and it's, yeah.
We then see Ripley wake up right next to Clemens, who says he appreciates her affections. I mean, is she using him? I don't think she actually likes him. I just think she's using him to find out exactly what happened to her friends.
Oh, I think it's exactly that.
We fade to black while focused on Ripley as the prisoners discover Murphy's body.
Well, what's left of it.
Yeah. Clemens comes into the picture and sees inconsistencies with how the body was sucked in and not blown out. Ripley discovers a flight recorder, but it is here where she is told by Clemens that Murphy was killed. He then tells her of the burn he discovered near his body and is requesting to know what is going on. Clemens is getting the runaround from the superintendent that the company considers Ripley a high priority. He then asks Clemens if there's anything he needs to know. We cut to Ripley finding Bishop and then her getting gang raped before Dylan comes and rescues her. This was a tough scene to watch.
But this also feels like an insert scene to show this is a strong woman. But also, there's a lot of scenes in this movie that feel like cliched prison drama type of sequences that almost feel like they have to be included. This is one of them.
Yeah, but you know what? She's not that I guess she is strong, but she's being saved by Dylan, who, by the way, said that he's just a raper of women. So why is he here saving her?
Because he's the good, he's the good rapist.
What, oh boy. What is good rape? Just the tip?
It doesn't make sense. And it's your point. This is that scene when you find out it's a prison. They're all males. Chastity, double Y chromosome. You know this scene is going to be in this film. And God, I wish it wasn't.
We're hearing some inmates try to figure out how big their compartment is as the candles start to go out. One of them investigates. Some alien blood falls beside him as he's attacked. We then see the alien come from the ceiling, much like in the first film, and takes an inmate up and kills him as Golic gets human blood sprayed right on his face and he starts going psychotic. Now this Golic character, in that assembly cut, he's more defined. He is also a bigger part in that comic, if you read it. He just kind of comes off as the guy saying that he spotted Jesus in his bread earlier that morning. In this particular cut, he looks like he's going psychotic, but he's the one who's seen it. He just can't really vocalize what it looks like and what exactly he saw.
Well, having seen both cuts, it's almost two entirely different characters. And the one that's in the theatrical cut is basically an afterthought. And when you realize what was in the assembly cut, you realize that by extension now, the theatrical one doesn't make a lick of sense.
He's functional barely. And yeah, the changes are such. I mean, it's somebody to see what happened. It moves the story, kinda.
Now, Adam, have you seen both cuts?
I saw the assembly once, and it was quite a while ago. I think it was like when they first dropped it, that first time that DVD set came out. I did not get a chance to rewatch it for this, so my memory of it is spotty.
One thing I'm going to ding Fincher on in this film is his inability to either show or tell us where the hell we are. There is no sense of geography here, and literally every set looks the exact same, so I never know where they are except the fact that there are rusted tubes all around them.
Yes, but that criticism doesn't veer into damnation for me, to use some religious allegory, until we get to the climactic sequence of the movie where I have no clue where anyone is.
Adam, did you have a geography problem here?
No, because I felt it was supposed to be that way. I mean, it's a small place, all the corridors and everything else. I don't find it much different than the other two films, really. I mean, you're lost in a dark place.
Ripley throws the bust of Bishop right on the autopsy table, and I have to say, Henriksen is my second favorite performance in this film. He gets one of the only laughs out of me this entire 2 hours as he compliments Ripley on her haircut, and he gives exposition that explains there is indeed an alien that got on board the Sulaco, which is what caused the electrical fire and is why the tubes were ejected. He goes on to say it was them the entire time and that the company knows, and they're coming to get the alien inside her. Adam, how'd you feel about the Bishop scene here?
Part of it is just a fun distraction. To see the way that she gets him, brings him back, and everything else, as darkly morbid as it is, Henriksen, I think, does a nice little job here with it. It's a good scene. It explains more than I remembered, because I'd been a couple years since I'd seen this. But I think it's a good break, and I think it's a good way to bring Bishop back, because I forgot that he was.
Henriksen does well. My problem is that it's ridiculous how this movie gives you so many hints and blatantly says that she's pregnant. But yet the movie still tries to treat it as a twist and a reveal when Ripley finds out.
Golic says that he's not the one who killed the other inmates, and it was actually a dragon. Ripley explains the concept of the alien, which, like in the previous film, is pretty much laughed out of the room. She learns there are no weapons here and nowhere to escape.
Sure, her last name shouldn't be Brody instead of Ripley. Because this feels like Jaws 2 all over again.
To be continued. The superintendent orders her quarantine. We hear Golic go on about marriage as Clemens closes the curtain and we hear the Clemens sob story. Again, another scene I just could have done without.
Yeah, this feels really out of place in your atmospheric quote-unquote horror movie to have the schmaltz put into it. This is the Phoebe Kate monologue from Gremlins about why she hates that holiday.
I hated this so much.
Yeah.
Yep. It's only saved by the fact that it ends with the alien coming in and killing him, and we get the shot from the trailer that if you have seen a poster or ad for this movie, you have seen this shot. Now, this is a shot I was talking about earlier. The studio told Fincher not to do this shot. They told him they didn't have the money for it, but Fincher was like, you know what, fuck it. He grabbed Sigourney Weaver, he grabbed Gillis to put the alien head on, and they went and they shot this. And I'm telling you right now, man, this movie doesn't have any of the feelings of the previous films, but this shot here is glorious. And you've seen it everywhere. Hell, we've had this Hawktua chick everywhere on the internet. I saw one of the Hawktua girl being the alien right next to Sigourney here. It's so well done. I love this shot so much.
It's a great shot. It's iconic. It's the trailer. It's been overdone at times. It teases and hints at what's to come. In its moment when it's done and it's a reveal, oh, it really is that good of a shot. Imagine if they didn't spoil this in the trailer, because this is,
yeah,
this is fantastic.
It also establishes while the alien had the perfect opportunity to kill Ripley, it won't because of what we will eventually learn is inside her. And Matt, I'm assuming that's a ding for you.
Well, this is the movie coming out right and say, see, she's pregnant. If you can't put it together yet, you have an IQ of 85 like somebody in this movie. It's a great shot, but it's kind of been ruined by the fact that once you see someone replace the alien with a stapler, it kind of loses some of its impact.
Yeah.
But this is also the jolt this movie desperately needed, because the first half is so downtrodden and sluggish. It doesn't have the pacing efficiency that either of the previous two movies had, because for a movie that's under 2 hours, this one feels the longest of the three by far.
It does. Ripley shows up in front of the superintendent to tell him that they are all in danger. As he yells at her and his crew for letting her roam around, the alien attacks them as well. I actually think some of these scenes and some of these kills are pretty well done.
I'm distracted by these kills, because since when does the xenomorph sit there and eat its victims to the point where it's just covering itself in blood? To the point that it's chomping. I feel like I'm watching frickin' the Predator in the Predators movie where it's just like chomping on a frickin' leg. I don't understand why the blood spray and everything else. It's such a change that it doesn't fit with what that character can even do. What is it opening its mandibles to eat with? I don't get it. So yeah, the kills, some of them are like horror movie slasher schlock, but it doesn't go.
Why are they treating it like it's a velociraptor?
Yeah.
Like, this is very much the precursor to Jurassic Park. And also, why is the xenomorph now okay with killing people in public? Everyone else up to this point, it's kind of been Dark Corridors, like a cheap slasher knockoff. This one, it just kills this guy clear as day. And it's supposed to be a stand-up-and-cheer moment because he's killing the authoritarian, but it's also comical the fact that everyone's just standing there watching it.
One guy has a chair up, and then as soon as it leaves, it's like, fuck! It's like, well, why didn't you do something? So we didn't get some ramblings from some anonymous ball guys. This scene just doesn't work, especially with all these goddamn accents. It's like, what is going on? Why are we here? I remember, and this is what you said, Matt, when I watched this movie initially, like I said, my parents were in the front room. They were working on the Christmas tree. They come in and they see this scene they walk in on, and all these guys are just like, fuck, fuck, fuck. And my parents, they're not demure, but they're like, God damn, do they see anything else in this movie? And I'm like, well, no, not really. These characters are just so fucking dumb.
Yeah, the dialogue, it might as well be written by Ryan Reynolds for Deadpool 2. I mean, there's not a whole lot there.
Ripley does say this alien moves differently than she has seen before. She is then taught the layout of the facility and starts her plan of attack. She's shown the toxic waste door and told that if they get something in there, there's no way of getting out.
I also hate how the movie has to outright say, and I hate this when movies do this, you mean to tell me that there's no way in and there's no way out? Like, the movie has to be that literal with presenting this, and this is the, well, I'm sure this will not come back later aspect of the movie.
We're learning that 85 is actually Aaron's IQ, and this was a character that, again, really rewritten. This character went through a lot of incarnations. It was a huge part of the story. Hell, it looked like he was more Clemens than anything else earlier on in the drafts, but he eventually just ended up being this anonymous 85 character. Dylan is not sold, but Ripley lays it all out there. Your ass is already on the line. What the fuck are you going to do about it? And Ripley is a very hard character to write for, I would imagine, but with the exception of the Clemens relationship, Matt, you're saying that she is just inconsistently written? Do you think she's not written well at all?
No, because her lines, you know, she made that comment about the writer making her talk like a washed-up gym teacher. That's mm-hmm. exactly what she sounds like. She reminds me of talking to a losing football team at halftime.
Adam, do you agree that her character is inconsistently written?
No, just because this woman's just been through it over and over, and she just found out that not only is she facing this alien again, but the corporation is also after her again. So, no, I feel that she's kind of at her wit's end at this point.
Ripley is showing signs of weakness, meaning that she's in the stages of pregnancy. We're also seeing the signal that tells them to light the fire, which is the flashing of a flashlight. We see a guy get taken out as he climbs a ladder, as he drops the fuse and the whole place lights up. And Fincher's using slow motion here, which, okay.
This whole scene is comical because they douse everything in this gasoline that they've had stored, but yet they're all walking around with lighters and lit up flares.
Yeah. Yes.
The dumbest prisoners. I know one of them has an IQ of 85, but Ripley should be smarter than this.
Ripley saying not to open the doors as they trudge through the wreckage. More planning goes on as Ripley once again falls sick and clutches her stomach. And we have some more pointless yelling. I swear to Christ, this is the adult version of Goonies. All these fucking adults just yelling for no goddamn reason.
Oh, this is basically the opening of Rob Zombie's Halloween for an hour and 50 minutes.
Yes.
Just white trash yelling.
Ripley crawls into a pod and x-rays her stomach, and she indeed finds out that she is pregnant with an alien queen.
oh my God, I didn't see this coming. This is such a surprise. Anybody? I think you could have made this reveal a little sharper. I do like that we use the pod. I don't really get the how you know what kind of alien it is. It's not a surprise, but I do think it's still effective.
If I put myself in Ripley's shoes, yes. But as an audience member, I'm already well indoctrinated to this fact. So playing it as a third act reveal doesn't work because there's been way too much foreshadowing. And not in a clever type of way, because so many of them, as I mentioned, are pretty blatant. Like, the movie doesn't really hide its hand all that particularly well.
They get communication going, and she says to tell them the whole place is toxic, which means the rescue team will turn back. We get word that the team is on their way, and Aaron doesn't respond, meaning they're still coming. Ripley heads down to hunt for the alien, knowing that it won't kill her. She says that she's part of the family, and she pulls a pipe and searches around until she spots it. I actually love this interaction. She tells it that it's been in her life for so long, she doesn't know anything else, and all she asks for is to do what it does. But when she stabs it, she sees it's just a pipe full of maggots. So it was a fucking red herring.
That line, thematically it works, but it's stupid when you think about it, because based on the fact of all the years she spent in cryo sleep, she's really only known the alien for technically 2 weeks of consciousness. So it doesn't make a lot of sense.
God, I hate maggots. That's such a dark, creepy little...
The alien is lodged behind her, though, as it drops down. Ripley tells Dylan that she has one inside her and that the alien won't kill her. She asks Dylan to kill her once all of this is done, as Alien Queen has to die. She asks him if he's up for it, and he responds with, "You don't have to worry about that." She leans against the bars and he swings beside her, telling her that as long as that alien's alive, he needs her to help fight it. God damn, another scene that just... I know they're trying, but this just doesn't work.
And she literally puts her arms out like she's on the cross.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, we'll see that later, too.
There's so much Christian allegory in this movie, it might as well be a Superman film.
More pointless yelling, and then Dylan somehow gives a motivational speech. Which, okay. And it also, this also does take me out when Ripley says that they think that we're crud. Like, that is the worst line. I don't know why. I can't hear Ripley saying crud. Like, she would say shit here, right, Adam?
Yes. It's not like this movie is held back in any way.
Exactly.
It's depiction, so it's...
The only thing they held back was all the good dialogue. It's in that same vault that all the gasoline was stored in.
We see another plan develop, this one involving pistons and lead. Oh God, this shot of the alien rock puppet had no business being here. God damn, this looks bad.
Also, this whole thing is so contrived, where you gotta lock it in and you only have 5 minutes. The third movie in a row that's gonna involve ejecting an alien.
Now, I do like the POV that Fincher is establishing here as it chases one of these anonymous bald guys through this maze. Even if I don't know where I'm going, neither does the alien. So, I kind of like this feeling. We're hearing different channels, which I guess is supposed to tell us where they are. But again, I'm just lost in this fucking maze.
Yeah, and it's not intentionally vague, because they keep mentioning so many doors where it's like, I'm in corridor H, closed door B.
Yeah.
You know, piston C. There's no sense of geography with where anything is. And it makes the last part of this movie incoherent as being kind. And because of that, I'm not engaged and I'm not scared for any of these characters.
Yeah, the doors, the maze, this whole sequence is so, it's so difficult to follow. It's so poorly done. What they're saying, why they're saying, you can't follow it. So there's just no tension because who knows what the hell is going on.
I was thinking of Ellie and the door locks.
Two more doors close, and there's a kind of a ticking clock, like you mentioned last week, Matt, as the company ship is shown getting close to landing.
Oh, do they decide to get close to landing? Because it looks like they decide to land 5 freaking kilometers away.
Right.
Standard sci-fi. We're going to park over there in the D lot.
Yeah. They went to the Imperial Flight School, because it's the Rogue One problem.
More chasing, waving of flares, and yelling as yet another door closes. Apostle Wade is killed with a tongue through the face as Ripley stops the piston from getting started. The company ship lands as we again see the alien on the ceiling. More POV shots happen and Kevin is killed. Ripley stares down the alien as the piston is turned on. Ripley makes her way as more mazes happen and one guy is completely decimated. Ripley is feeling the effects of the pregnancy as the company comes through and Aaron tells them where Ripley is. Golic is taken out as Ripley eggs the alien on. Huh? They get stuck as she's...
Sorry, she eggs the alien on, huh?
Oh, you like that, huh? I didn't even catch that. It gets stuck as she's dragged away by Dylan as Morse shuts the door. He then makes his way up the ladder as the alien fights through the door and Ripley is determined to die. Dylan says that he needs to hold it there. as he takes his glasses off and says, fuck you. Now, this was supposed to be Aaron here, but it's Dylan who's the one who kind of takes the heroic death of distracting the alien.
It's not just distracted. It's the fact that he literally fist fights the alien.
Yes.
And talks trash while he does it.
And he's talking shit. This is the precursor to Busta Rhymes fighting Michael Myers. What you have is Xenomorph, the most terrifying thing in a movie of this ilk, be evenly matched against a prisoner who is, might as well be played by Sam Jackson. It's that level of stereotyping. I can't take this seriously, and I will never be able to take the alien as a viable threat from this moment on. I hate this scene so much, I can't even put it into words.
What's really bad about this, too, is, okay, what is Ripley's plan? She needs to trap the alien, kill the alien, and kill herself. If she stayed down there, the alien would come to her, it's not going to kill her, and they could literally dump it all on the both of them at one shot. That she decides that she's going to climb up completely just eliminates her plan for how to eliminate this alien.
The alien attacks Dylan, as Matt says in the fist fight, as Morse pours the lead. The lead falls, but the alien springs out of it. As the alien pursues Ripley, she douses it with water. And remember how way at the beginning of this podcast I mentioned there was only one CGI shot in the entire movie? Here it is, as the alien makes its way up and its head cracks. That was all CGI, but that's it. And I think that looks pretty good, actually, when they do it.
Yeah, it looks cool, but the science behind it is complete bullshit.
It's so stupid. I agree with you.
Let me think of the 2005 Fantastic Four, where they superheat Dr. Doom without his body and turn on the fire hydrant and he stops moving.
Yeah. So we then see the alien explode into bits, and I have to say, I didn't have Morse escaping on my bingo card.
The only thing that's missing from the scene are 3D glasses. It's like, Jaws 3 did this earlier, Freddy's dead, they blow him up at the end.
Ripley then pulls herself up and is greeted by the company, headed by old Lance himself. I guess if you have him, you need to use him as more than just a pile of milk on a table. He says he's there as a friendly face, and the company wants to kill the thing inside her and take her home. Allowing it to live would put the entire planet in jeopardy. He sells her on a new life as she asks whether or not he'll destroy the alien when he takes it out, and he just says that she just needs to trust him. She doesn't, though, as she closes the gate and asks Morse to help her. She looks at the company and performs the ultimate sacrifice by jumping into the steel. All
right, so before we get to that, this is another reminder of how the Weyland-Yutani Corporation is a conglomerate that is too stupid to win anything. How did they think this is going to work? She has no reason to believe any of this. And as she mentioned and told the prisoners, crew and Marines were both expendable. But yet they thought just because they sent a human who looks like an android that she would buy into all this nonsense. Give them the Umbrella logo and call this Resident Evil because it's that level of stupid implausibility.
Well, Resident Evil, the Terminator 2 edition, because this is exactly how the Terminator 2 ended the year before.
Walked off the set and said, all right, you guys can use this.
Yeah.
Except instead of a thumbs up, he gave them the middle finger.
I saw that joke coming and it still landed. I mean, you could think that there's a million ways that Yutani, if they really wanted to get her, could have done it instead of just, we're going to do the stupidest thing possible.
Why I think this sacrifice works, and one thing about this movie that was pretty important to both Weaver and Fincher, was that they show Ripley in the five stages of grief. We've seen her denial, we've seen her anger, we've seen her bargaining, we've seen her depression, and now this is her acceptance. Like, look, this is how it's going to be, and her sacrificing herself is the ultimate acceptance and the ultimate sacrifice. So with that, I can go with. I cannot go with this effect, though. This effect looks terrible, as we've been saying this entire movie, and I hate saying that, but I do like her kind of caressing it as she's falling. Again, more acceptance, but with the exception of that, and of course, this was also a Weaver mandate. Weaver wanted to die in this movie. She was done with it. We'll talk next week. But at this point, she was done. So her dying here, it works for me on a concept level, and when I talk about the five stages of grief, it really works. But when I see it actually executed, it makes me sad because I think it could have really worked. In the assembly cut, we have her jumping in without the alien coming out of her chest. And here it's pretty convenient that as she jumps, the alien's hatching. I like, again, the concept of it actually hatching as she falls. I think that works better.
I think it goes back to, especially if you haven't seen the director's cut of the other films, she's literally giving birth. So it goes back to that mother part of her as well. I think it fits. I think it's a full circle, Ripley and the alien and their life cycle, for lack of a better term, that they've gone through together. So no, I kind of need that alien bursting out of her. As much as they do a piss poor job every time they're deciding to blue screen something behind it, whether it's the alien, whether it's Ripley, to me it's an effective shot. It's, again, the Christ metaphors go so frickin' much through this, but it is the ending that is most fitting, I think.
So I have no issue with her dying. My issue is I hate how this movie, all of its big notes are played so literally. They literally have to show the alien bursting out of her before she dies, as if we can't emphatically insinuate that that's actually going to happen. There's no ripple effect when she lands in the acid. That pissed me off every time. I've had that since Ninja Turtles 3. When the guy falls in the water, there's a splash, and then 5 seconds later, there's the sound. But I can't bring myself to take this seriously because of the pretense that led up to her deciding to do this. To Adam's point, she could have drowned herself in the molten lead. The Yutani company doesn't take her by force, which you think they've had 3 shots. They would be like, all right, fuck this. We're just going to take her prisoner. And the fact they allow this to happen is just obscene. So I like it in concept, but I hate its execution, to go back to what you guys said about so many of the Star Wars movies. And again, this whole scene is basically, you know, in Total Recall, when they send the doctor in to give Schwarzenegger the pill, where it's like, okay, why would Cohagen do that in the first place if the plan is working? I have that same problem here where it's like, okay, why are you doing this in this method?
The only possible reason I can think of is to get Lance Henriksen once again on the screen. And Lance Henriksen himself has denounced this movie also since it's come out.
Well, cut out his one line when he gets hit. He's like, I'm not a droid.
We're hearing the Ripley Alien 1 sign off one more time as a transmission from the company comes in and says that the Weyland-Yutani file on Fury 161 is now sealed. Custodial presence has been terminated and the remaining refinery equipment will be sold as scrap. We see the end of transmission as credits roll on Alien 3, boys. Wow.
I'm kind of glad they finished it with that transmission, but it feels like that wraps it up. Yeah, it's a trilogy at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah, for 6 years.
Stay tuned. Scale of 1 to 10. What do we give Alien 3? We've had some pretty harsh things to say about this, but let's see what our scores end up. Adam, what say you, sir?
This is, as we discussed at the beginning of this, the film that a lot of people discuss when it comes to where franchises break down, where they change, the what the hell happened to type series that you'll see on YouTube and such like that, almost always start or end with this film for pretty good reason. This takes a giant left turn through a quadrant of space that I don't think most people would have understood. Maybe in space they can't hear you scream, but they can make you question their frickin' choices. From the just convoluted writing, production history, the studio mandate, the casting choices, the dark nihilistic view and way that this film does, it's an extremely dour film. Is it bad? Well, it's not good. We came through two of the best sci-fi films of all time with Alien and Aliens. And I think that's the biggest problem with this thing, is it came off two of the best films in its genres, multiple types, whether it's action, thriller, sci-fi, all of the above. So Sigourney Weaver, I think, does come to play. I think she gets what she wants to do in the way of the script and the character, and I think she's pretty damn good. Everybody else is just an also-ran. Charles Dutton, I like him in things, but he's such a caricature. Charles Dance in his young age, and it's funny that this is him playing with a dragon before he goes to the House of, but he's killed off so soon. That doesn't have a chance. And everybody else is the same damn character. This is, as much as he wants to deny it, this is a Fincher film. It's dark, it's moody, it's nihilistic, it's shot like a music video. That doesn't make it good. It's not horrible. If you're in that depressed, what the hell kind of mood, this is that film. It's not the worst film in the franchise. I don't even know if it's the second worst film in the franchise. We'll have to discuss that as we go. But it's not good. It's worth watching as a completionist, and that's about it. I'm going to give it a 5. I think that's kind of what it deserves. I don't think it deserves a horrendous reputation, but it's not a film to hold up in the Alien pantheon.
5 out of 10 for Mr. Bunch. Goudreau, you've been the most harsh out of the three of us. What do you say?
Well, a lot of people, to Adam's point, will point to this installment as the template for franchises going off the rails, that it's a bad sequel, it undoes all the good work from the first two. It casts a dark shadow over the franchise, the black sheep, and those people are right. This is a movie that I wanted to, the first time it was over, put the blame solely at the feet of David Fincher.
And I can't bring myself to do that in good conscience because it wouldn't be fair. I put the brunt of this on Walter Hill, David Giler, and 20th Century Fox. This is not a unified vision, and there was no chance it was going to be with all the production hell. Way to get around that was just to take this concept and focus on an entirely new set of characters. But by bringing them back, you both do the aliens characters a disservice by nonchalantly disposing of them like they're cannon fodder. Might as well have red shirts. And you take a character in Ripley who was so clearly defined that I really got attached to and reduced her to a cliche. And that's a real sticking point I cannot get past. This movie, in a lot of ways, is a regression in everything. In storytelling, characterization, special effects, and horror by comparison. Because Aliens is an action movie first. But when the scares happen in that movie, as we alluded to, they're bone-chilling. There's nothing in this movie outside of one shot that Fincher had to fight for that evokes any semblance of terror. So, yeah, it's compromised, and I know it's coming off two iconic movies, but that doesn't mean I have to give this a pass. And I'm sorry, sequels, you gotta escalate. You gotta match the quality. Otherwise, I'm gonna be a hell of a lot harsher. So, I'm not gonna say that this is the worst installment in the franchise, but it's certainly the worst of the three by a wide margin. So this is a 3 on 10 for me. This has been a movie. Wow. I have hated this movie ever since I first saw it. And I have finally seen the producer's cut, the assembly cut. It is better, but it's improving a foundation that is already rotted. Aesthetically, it makes the house look better, but all the floorboards are already apart, and you can't bring yourself to improve it. So it's a 3. It's the worst thing David Fincher has ever made. And I'm sorry, it's still your movie. As much as you want to disown it, there's a lot more of your style on it than you're willing to admit. So, 3 out of 10 for me.
An Alien 3 out of 10 for Alien 3 from Mr. Goudreau. As with a lot of things with this movie, I'm of two minds. On one end, I think this is a really well done illustration of the 5 stages of grief by Mr. Fincher and Miss Weaver. On the other end, as an Alien film, it fails on a lot of levels. And Matt, you kind of stole my thunder earlier when you said if you're going to take away the two people that you really cared about at the end of the last film, you got to replace them with people that you care about. You know, it's just the way these films work. I mean, you take a main character like Ripley, you need to surround her with people that make you want to root for her and them to get out. I do root for Ripley because I do feel her pain. I don't look at the fact that she is revealed as being pregnant as a reveal. I just look at that as a plot point. I look at it as she is finally accepting who she is by the end. And when she kills herself, that is the true definition of acceptance. And I can go with that. And I really, really endorse Weaver's performance in this movie. I think I would have nominated her for an Oscar for this as well. The problem is that it's contained within some piss poor effects, some really, real inconsistent writing, real inconsistent producing. I think putting this at the feet of Fincher is kind of unfair, but at the same time, he is to blame for a lot of the flaws that this movie has. But he does bring some good things. He brings some low angles that I liked. He brings a lot of his nihilistic approach, which is consistent through all his films and work on Netflix. I do think there are some things to admire here, but at the same time, just going through this, going through with these characters, it's not a fun time. I'm going to give it the slight edge. I want to give it a 6, slightly over a 5, double Matt's score, because I think the way it handles the 5 stages of grief is very well done. I think the way it handles the alien, and I think the way it handles what's going on around Ripley, and I think the way it handled this entire production is so flawed that I can't give it much higher than that. But I admire the work that Weaver does here, and I admire a lot of what Fincher does. I just can't admire this movie as a whole. But 6 is still pretty good, and you're not going to expect to smile too much in this. This is a very downtrodden film. You can't watch this and come out of it with your fist pumping like you did last week. But if you're ready to accept, like Ripley is by the end of this, I think you'll get some, not joy, but some entertainment out of this film. So 6 out of 10 for me on Alien 3. Boys, this movie was so downtrodden, you couldn't go any lower than what Ripley does in this film. So next week we get a movie that is a little lighter. Another movie that went through so many hands, including those of Joss Whedon, which is a script that we will be talking about next week. Alien Resurrection came out in 97. I was there in theaters. I believe, Adam, I might have gone with you. What do we think we're going to say next week when we get to Alien Resurrection? Adam?
I think it's going to be a discussion about course correcting that studios do when tone takes over a film.
And I think that's kind of what happens. I think we see an emergence of a writer and a tone that we hadn't seen up to this point.
Matt?
Oh, you guys are going to fucking hate me next week.
All right. Can't be any more than The Last Jedi. But we'll see. Maybe. And next week, we'll have Alien Resurrection. After that, we have so many things coming up. We have so many plans. We are going to get to more King by the end of the year. Stay tuned for that. And I think our final set of retrospectives are going to please a lot of people. So stay tuned for those announcements. But I think these Alien shows have been some of our best shows we've done. So I want to thank you guys for joining me on this journey. Very, very depressing journey with this film. But let's see what we have to say next week. Until we get to next week when we talk Alien Resurrection. With these shows, we commit these podcasts to the void with a glad heart. Thank you, gentlemen.
We better get back, because it'll be dark soon, and they mostly come at night. Mostly.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
Now what the fuck are we supposed to do?
Come back every Friday, as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
Look, I'm telling you, there's something moving and it ain't us!
And if you would be so kind, please take a moment and give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice.
Could kill him.
I'm willing to take that chance. Just cut it off and then.
You take responsibility?
Yes, yes, I'll take the responsibility. Get him out of here.
It truly helps others find and discover our podcasts.
How far would you go to get what you came all this way for? Your answers.
Check out the Percolated Media Archives, as we have tons of franchise reviews, including Star Wars, the Mad Max movies, Avatar, movies featuring the team-up of Leonardo DiCaprio and Martin Scorsese, the film adaptations of author Stephen King, films of the DC Universe featuring Superman and Batman, Jurassic Park, and so many more.
Stop your grinning and drop your linen.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
Oh, great. Wonderful. Shit.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
How are you, you stupid cat?
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
You started this. Show me everything. I can handle myself.
Yeah, I noticed.
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
They ain't paying us enough for this, man.
This podcast is for entertainment purposes, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
Thank you, that will be all.
God damn it, that's not all! Because if one of those things gets down here, then that will be all. Then all this bullshit that you think is so important, you can just kiss all that goodbye!
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is a Percolated Media production. All rights reserved, and no copyright infringement is intended.
Commercial starship Nostromo. Third officer reporting. The other members of the crew. Kane, Lambert, Parker, Brett, Ash, and Captain Dallas are dead. Cargo and ship destroyed. I should reach the frontier in about 6 weeks. With a little luck, the network will pick me up. This is Ripley, last survivor of the Nostromo, signing off.
That's it, man. Game over, man. Game over.
Adam, are you in a hospital? Where are you? Why do you sound so hollow?
Do I sound hollow?
Yes.
God damn it.
It's okay.
Oh, hang on. Let me unplug and replug back in my headset.
Okay.
I'm just going to pull a fish up and recirculate.
So he is basically going off the seat of his pants directing this movie.
And it's funny, looking at the way how this is done, this one is something that I think you boys can appreciate. Anybody thinking Bash at the Beach? Someone's got final say back there in the locker room.
Oh, God.
We're making decisions on the fly.
Well, if he had it his way, David Fincher would have walked out halfway on set, rolled camera, and said, that's why this company's in the crapper, because of bullshit like this. And then Walter Hill and David Giler would have come out a la Vince Russo and run him over with a truck.
All right, now that we alienated